Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Ooh.
Here's John Williams.
That's me doing my impersonation of somebody who ran the marathon going down steps today. I hope you're feeling well. And I hope you had a great weekend. This is John. We're here weekdays till 3. We start at 1. Saturdays, we do a show from 10 a.m. till noon. Don't miss the Mincing Rascals podcast. Our weekly podcast drops Thursdays around 5 p.m. Maybe you had a chance to listen to it over the weekend. You can always hear the Mincing Rascals on Spotify, or just tell your smart speaker, play the Mincing Rascals on TuneIn. It's on my mind because over the weekend at our Teddy Roosevelt show at the College of at Elgin Community College, a lot of you came up to us afterwards and said, we love the Mincing Rascals. Hats off to Eric Zorn and Steve Bertrand and our cast and crew that put that together each week, because they're all the reason that podcast is so good. I'll talk more about Teddy Roosevelt in a minute, but first, I know Bill and Wendy mentioned this, but you cannot help but walk downtown Chicago today and see people everywhere with the blue ribbons and the big silver heavy medallions that they're wearing, which shows that they finished the Chicago Marathon over the weekend. I saw 45,000 people was the number of runners, but some of the runners that went by us had numbers on them that were in the 62,000s. So I'm not exactly sure how you could have 62,000 on your jersey, and yet there was only 45,000 runners. Maybe not every 1,000 category got filled out. They stagger the people, so the fast runners go first, and the wheelchair riders and athletes, and then, you know, if you think you're going to run it in 3 hours, you're in this group, and then behind them is 3.5. And then, as you probably know, if you've seen it before, they have people that are pace setters, and they run the whole race at the pace that you think you'd like to go, and they hold the stick up in the air with a sign, 3:10, 3:20. I'm in the 3:30 group. I'm going to finish in 3 hours and 30 minutes. It's hard enough to do it, let alone do it with a stick in the air. But when you do stand there and watch the marathon, and Brenda and our daughter-in-law Nikki and I stood there for 3 hours and cheered from about 8 in the morning till about 11 in the morning.
Man, that sounds exhausting, John.
I can't brag about how arduous it was, but it was arduous. We were freezing and we were ringing cowbells and cheering.
Did your feet hurt?
My feet hurt. As I'm sitting there sipping coffee with an Ann Sather cinnamon roll in my hand, and there's these people going by. You know, it's funny because it should be enough to just run the marathon. A guy went by us in the like 3 hour, 30 minute group. So figure the first maybe 25% of the people. In other words, here's a guy going pretty fast, and he's juggling.
What?
He was juggling three little balls in the air as he's running along. Imagine running 26 miles. Imagine doing it fast with your arms extended in front of you. Imagine holding your arms in front of you for 3.5 hours and juggling the whole time.
Why?
That sounds crazy.
I saw a guy go by in about the middle of the pack dressed as a cartoon character. I saw a lot of people as Wonder Woman. A few women dressed up as Wonder Woman. I saw, this is just so touching, there were some people who were blind, not sighted, and so they would be running along, and then they would have two people running on either side of them to guide them. So it's a runner, and then as they go by, you see it says guide on the back of them. And the three of them are carefully navigating the crowded pack of people running forever through Chicago. Your heart goes out to all of them. There were some people that were pushing a wheelchair. There were some people that had their name or their country on their front. You know, all 50 states were represented, and I forget how many countries. But it was just so fun because we'd be standing there, and here'd be somebody, and you could tell they're from Mexico. And you say, go, Mexico! And they look at you, and they smile. You have these virtually anonymous two-second-long interactions that are generous on both parts. You know, they appreciate your applauding and then shouting out their name or their country, and then they give you back a smile and a thumbs up and go, woo, as they wake their way on. But then they're gone. 2 seconds later, it's history, and then here comes somebody else. So we did this for 3 hours, just calling out names. We were waiting for a couple of people that we were looking for to greet them. But mostly it was just anonymously lobbing out, go Poland! A lot of Palestinians. There was a Palestinian group. And so it just said Palestinians for something or another. I couldn't make it all out because whew, they were going by. But that's just the great joy of the Chicago Marathon. It's not about the athleticism of it. It's not about the world records. It's about people who are doing something extraordinarily important to them and people who don't know them, giving them so much support. And there's just this international exchange for several hours going on throughout the city. All positive, all love, all anonymous, all good.
You know, it's funny, life is a marathon, but we sure don't treat it that way, and we should. That's my deep moment for you right there, John.
You should say that again. I'm going to get some music, too, you know. Deep thoughts from Lauren. Because that is so true. So I'll stop talking about it, but I have strong feelings about this every single year that I go there. And I feel the same way every time. It never disappoints. There's just this, and it's funny too, because there's all body shapes, styles, and sizes. Like if you walk around downtown Chicago today, everybody's wearing their medallions. I think you get to, but if you have it on next week, it's time to put it in a drawer. Okay. But you get to wear it today and you got to wear it at the restaurants last night. And thank you for spending money in our city. Right.
And it will hang on the shelf. You can post that up.
Yes. But you don't wear it to work on Tuesday.
No.
Okay. It's like, I know it's important to you. Put it away now. But it brings so much business into this city. Holy cow.
Hold on a second. If they didn't go to work today, why can't they wear it tomorrow for work?
I don't know. It's sort of like Christmas lights at Valentine's Day. It's time to take them down. I'm not sure how long you get to have that light turned on. Maybe. All right. I'll give you Tuesday if you don't go to work on Columbus, Indigenous Peoples Day.
There you go.
Wednesday, okay, Elif, are we in agreement on that? Wednesday, it's in a drawer. Or Wednesday, it's tacked to the bulletin board or wherever you put your stuff. But it was just very nice to see, and congratulations to everybody that did it. Woman's record set. And then there was the story, of course, over the weekend about how although they did recently have the New York City Marathon, our Lou Manfredini's son ran in the New York City Marathon. But in Vienna, they set the world record for the fastest marathon run ever. And now the international body that recognizes marathon times isn't sure that they love it. I don't understand this. I don't understand why if this Kipchoge guy runs the marathon faster than anybody has, but he didn't do it in an officially sanctioned marathon, and he had help, that is, runners pacing him, et cetera, et cetera. It's still a guy running. I mean, right? You can't take away 26.2 miles from somebody. I don't care how much quote-unquote help they got. Your legs still have to go in front of each other. He averaged 4 minutes and 34 seconds a mile. Let me double check that. What was his average speed? 4:34. I've thought about this before because that's what I do. If you run a mile in 4 minutes and 34 seconds, that means that you're running a quarter mile in about a minute and 7 seconds. Have you run around a high school track in a minute and 7 seconds, 67 seconds? That means that you're running halfway around the track. You're running, say, an eighth of a mile in about 38 seconds. Or you're running a 110-yard dash in about 19 seconds. Say, a 100-yard dash in about 16 seconds. Try that. Try and run 100 yards in 16 seconds. You know, the fastest people in the world do it in 10 or 11. So can you do it in 16? And then can you do that for 2.5 hours at that pace? The point is, most of us can't run the length of a football field at the speed these people will run for 26 miles. It's just insane. It's like not human. So how is this guy able to do it over the weekend? I've seen his name a million times. I've never pronounced it correctly. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya. But this is what they said in a story about him in the New York Times yesterday. What materialized on Saturday was perhaps the most finely tuned, carefully orchestrated marathon-length run in history. Kipchoge got out of his hotel bed at 4:50 a.m. and had oatmeal for breakfast. At 8:15, after a three-hour wait that he called the hardest time ever in my life, he set out along a picturesque bridge spanning the Danube and charged across a stretch of downhill road that led him to a park. And there he ran around a 9.6-kilometer flat circuit. So he's essentially running the marathon around this track. More than 90% of it unfurled in a straight line. So he'd go down, make a relatively sharp turn, and then come all the way back, two long lines back and forth with turns at either end. Portions of the road were painted with lines to highlight the fastest possible path. You don't normally get that. He wore a white singlet, white sneakers, Nikes, as of yet unreleased to the public, built around a carbon fiber plate. So he had a special carbon fiber plate in his shoe to maybe give him strength, maybe spring, I don't know. He had immense support. He ran behind an electric timing car, driving at 4 minutes and 34 seconds per mile, with a second car on standby in case something happened to this one. And with his flock of rotating pace setters, 35 people on the course, with six on reserve. The pace setters happened to include some of the best distance runners in the world, including former world and Olympic gold medalists. Those pace makers wore black jerseys and stern expressions, and they formed a protective aerodynamic pocket around Kipchoge, five of them running in front in an open V formation, and two more in the back. So he had guys, you know, he was essentially drafting off of this arrow of five guys running in front of him. And when they would get tired, they'd spin off, and then more guys would run in front of him and break the air so that it was more aerodynamic for him. You don't normally get that. This is maybe why it's not sanctioned, but still, the guy was running the race, right? He was still doing it on his own.
I wonder how much of a difference it really could make. Because, I mean, right. If there was no wind blowing at all, then that would be fractions, I would think.
Right. And right. It's not like we're doing 60 miles an hour. It's not like we're Indy cars here and we're drafting off of each other. Or even bicycles, I understand. But have you ever run so fast that you thought, wow, if I just had somebody right in front of me? Well, I guess distance runners appreciate that. Well, that's what they did for him. So there were 35 on the course, six on reserve, fastest runners in the world that could keep up with him. Remember, they're all running 4 minutes and 34 seconds a mile. So they formed this protective V in front of him. They knew exactly where to run, thanks to a pattern of thick green laser beams projected onto the street by the timing car. Remember, he's following the line that's painted, but then where do the other guys go to form the most perfect aerodynamic V in front of him? Laser beam lights are shooting out in front of them, and they're told to run on those spots behind the pace car. Think about all of the science that went into this.
Such a choreographed morning jog.
I know, really. Some of us would just be happy to have a cup of coffee and walk the dog. A team member on a bicycle periodically pedaled into the pack to deliver Kipchoge a carbohydrate-heavy cocktail of gels and fluids. Looking at the 1:59:40 time, I got so emotional, said one of those pace-setting runners. Down the final stretch, as it was clear that the milestone was easily in reach, remember, they're trying to see if a human being can run a marathon in under 2 hours, and he did it in 1 hour, 59 minutes, and 40 seconds. So he broke the barrier by 20 seconds. As they were heading down the stretch, the pace setters, the timing car, and accompanying cyclists all peeled away, leaving Kipchoge alone to soak in the shouts and applause of the crowd. After crossing the finish line, Kipchoge jumped into the arms of his wife, Grace, and children. Through all of his years of competition and all of the victories and medals and records in his career, this was the first time his family had watched him run in person. That's amazing. Okay, so that's just a little bit of my weekend. I hope you had a good one, too. A couple of texts about marathon runners. John, the wind wasn't fun for the runners, but kudos to all of the volunteers and spectators who braved the cold. I think that wind was, I know they like cooler weather, but that wind and cold was hard for the runners on Sunday. John, I am just now starting to be able to walk after the race and overcame a fever after the race. That juggler who ran has been doing that for more than 10 years. There are superheroes, lots of fun characters. In 2012, I saw a GI in combat gear and boots and a 50-pound backpack running the marathon. Wow.
I've seen someone go barefoot. I think that's the craziest thing I've seen in a marathon.
That looks hard, doesn't it?
Just extremely painful. You know, those streets aren't exactly cleaned, so you got little rocks, glass. Ugh.
John, my medal is put away now. I wore it until my shower last night. I didn't have the energy to take it off yesterday. I mentioned the Lou Manfredini's son's running in the New York Marathon. I made it sound like he already had, but somebody pointed out that that race is November 1st. And finally, John, pacing him, creating a wedge to break the wind for him, had a pace car with a laser pointer for the best location, and held it over the course of 9 days to get the most favorable conditions for the wind. Yeah, they did all of that. I wouldn't ratify the results of that marathon either. I would. It's a 129. WGN Radio News with Steve Bertrand coming up. Then you tell me what you think about the kids starting school later in the day. Steve, we always feature a replay of something we did previously on the show after your 1:30 news. Here we are. Normally I play it straight out. I'll play it for you in just a second after a preliminary comment. And about that business of running the marathon in Chicago, or Kipchoge, the guy from Kenya who broke a world record. Nobody has been able to run a marathon in under 2 hours. He did, but should they sanction that? We wondered, because he had a lot of assistance, a pace car, guys running in a V formation in front of him to block the wind, stuff like that. John, there were a lot of Hong Kong freedom runners in the Chicago Marathon, too. As the back of the pack runner, it was great for me to hear fellow runners who had nothing but great things to say about Chicago. I hope so. Hey, John Williams, it is standard for marathons to paint a tangent line on the course for the most direct route. Chicago does it. Having it for Kipchoge is not unusual. What's unusual is superhuman performance. Pacers, pace car and all, he still had to run 26.2 miles himself. Nobody ran his legs for him. It was an epic performance. But this one from 815 says, that sub-2-hour marathon was amazing for all of the reasons you mentioned, John, but you seriously believe that having runners blocking for the wind for you doesn't help you? If that's so, then you have, one, never run a race of any kind in your life, and number two, are completely out of your mind. If it were possible to break 2 hours without all of the extra help, it would have been done already. Kipchoge is a great runner. But not that much better than others before him. Okay. Well, actually, I get the point. I see how that helped and how it was different. I still think it's pretty amazing. I mean, I'm not on the sanctioning board, but if somebody asks me what's the fastest anybody's ever run a marathon, I'll now say 1 hour, 59 minutes, and 40 seconds. That's amazing. That's amazing. Teddy Roosevelt was on stage at Elgin Community College at the Blizzard Theater. And he started out by talking about something that happened on October 14th, not October 14th, 2019, but here we are looking at October 14th, 2019 today. And it was October 14th. Oh, shoot. Now, I don't know the year. Was it 1902, 1903? Not exactly, right around there. But it was on this date that he was in nearby Milwaukee when this happened.
I was in Milwaukee, I believe it was October 14th, 1912. It was a long and exhausting campaign, even for me, giving 4, 5, 6, 10 speeches per day all over the, you know, traveling by train and speaking from the back of trains and so on. And I was exhausted by now. Everyone, I suppose, was. I was campaigning against Taft, the incumbent, and against this pathetic Professor Wilson from Princeton, a man that I called a Byzantine logothete. And I'm not even sure what that means, but and so we were all exhausted, and my handler said, just rest, but the local The local group had wanted me to go to supper, so we did. And then we had to rush to the auditorium now, so we were going to go in a jalopy. And I started to sit down in this jalopy, and from the street, from about right here, a man named John Schrank took out a pistol and shot me at point-blank range. I slumped in the seat. Blood was shooting out of my chest. I said, he pinked me. I'm an old big game hunter. I spit into my hand, and I noticed there was no blood in the spittle. So that means that although I was very seriously wounded, it probably was not going to be mortal. So I said, let's go give the speech. And so we did. We went to the auditorium. I had been saved because I had a steel spectacles case and my 50-page speech folded up. And together they slowed the bullet so that it, although it lodged in my ribs, it did not enter my heart or cut an artery. So I said, I'm going to give this speech if it's the last speech that I ever give. Off we went. Of course, my handlers were beside themselves with panic. I got there. I stood up about here at a podium, and blood was still shooting out of my chest. My whole shirt was covered with blood. And I said to the somewhat hushed audience, I want you to know that I may not be at full strength tonight. You see, I have just been assassinated. And so then I gave an 84-minute speech. By the time it was over, I was suffering from some loss of blood. And finally, my handler said, you know, you simply must come with us now. And so I said, I forgive me, I must go. So I came down the center stairs, and people lined up all across the aisle to shake my hands. One of my handlers later said, Colonel Roosevelt, you realize everyone just wanted to be the last person ever to shake your hand.
Yeah, that would be the last chance. It'd be the last you ever see of him. But, of course, he survived that and then recovered in Chicago. So 107 years ago today is when that happened in Milwaukee. He recuperated here and then gave a famous strenuous life speech. Anyway, thanks to those of you that came to see the show at Elgin Community College. I expect we'll do one next spring and or next fall for sure with TR or TJ, Thomas Jefferson. Okay, so we asked you, what do you think of what they're doing in California? They've made it the law that grade schoolers can't go to school before 8 a.m. and high schoolers don't start until after 8:30 in the morning. Some of you still want to talk about the marathon, too. We'll start with Pam. Hi, Pam. You're on WGN.
Hey, John.
What's on your mind?
Well, my kids start school at 7:45. They're in elementary, and it is hard. They get so much homework at night, and they don't get into bed until 8:30, 9 o'clock. So to have like an extra hour or even two would be awesome. It would help them with their classwork. It would help them be more focused.
Yeah.
But right now, the 7:45, it's three of us having to get all of us ready in the morning. We're up at like 5:30 in the morning. It's hard. It's really hard.
And, you know, we just sort of take it for granted. Well, that's the way it is. And you think, well, it doesn't have to be that way if we let everybody sleep an extra hour.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think adding like another hour or two would definitely help. But then again, it's like I'm a single parent. The later I get them there, it's hard for me to get to work, too. I have to be here at 9. So then again, 7:45 works because I can get to work at 9. But it sucks for them, that's all.
Well, it's funny because that's what somebody said. We all know that kids going to school early is hard for the kids. That's not why we do that because it accommodates the adults' work schedule.
Right.
That's what it's all about.
Right, exactly. Right.
Well, all right, so if that happens, good luck to you, Pam.
Right. Thanks.
Be careful what you ask for.
I know. All right, have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Hey, Jeff, you're on WGN.
Yeah, John.
Hey.
My daughter was in a marathon about 3 years ago in Boston, and I saw that gentleman running that whole marathon on pavement in bare feet.
Oh, no kidding. Really?
Yes, bare feet.
That's so
much. I don't understand what kind of feet he's got, but that was amazing.
I wonder if the person that does that is doing that for show or they actually think it's easier for them. It's better for them.
I don't know, but he must have some one heck of his shoes, feet, skin, tough,
shoe
leather.
Right.
One more real quick thing, John.
Yeah.
You mentioned last week about that gentleman that gave all that money to the museum.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And
Ken Griffin, yeah.
And I got this off of Wally Phillips when we used to listen to Wally Phillips all the time when he was on. A million seconds, John, is 12 days. A billion seconds is 32 years.
The point being, if you have $1 billion, you have...
a whole bunch of money.
More. I know, we kind of lumped those two together. A million, a billion, it's all the same. No, it's not.
No, it's not. But the average mind cannot depict, when you say a difference between a million and a billion, well, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But we can't absorb it in our minds and visualize how much money that really is.
Well, you must have a lot. If you give $125 million to the Museum of Science and Industry, then you'd better have a billion. But give me the million and billion again. A million seconds is...
a million, 12 days.
Yeah.
A billion seconds is 32 years.
There you go. There you go. Hey, what an interesting call.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, that's the great Wally Phillips, who used to work here, who did more than work here. We stand on that man's shoulders. And he still remembers some of the things Wally said. John, the best running costume I've ever seen during the marathon was the guy who ran as Forrest Gump. Maureen reminded me that the man who coaches the Crossroads Runners marathon team ran his 100th marathon on Sunday. For John Williams, it is standard for marathons to paint a tangent line on the course for the most direct route. Chicago does it. No, we already read that one. We have a lot of you, though, about the school start times. And Lombard School starts at 7:25. 7:25 in the morning. If you had a high schooler, they'd get an extra hour and 5 minutes or so, right, to sleep anyway. I'm not sure when you get up if you go to school at 7:25. But remember, in California, schools will start high school after 8:30 in the morning. John Schomburg High starts at 7:30. John, you can't do these late starts. My kids have before and after activities and sports. John, Plainfield High School starts at 7:10 in the morning. That sounds early to me, 7:10. John, many studies show that learning after 9 is much better. The earlier start times are for our work schedules, not for the kids' benefits. But I knew we'd get something like this. It's only a matter of time before they let the kids just come in when they feel like it, just like they're getting rid of library late fees and wanting to do away with prison times where everybody was just misunderstood. Thank you for the text. You can call or text 312-981-7200. John, some of the kids have to catch the bus as early as 6:25. Wondered what you thought about them starting it later in the day.
Think about all the after-school jobs, too, not just activities.
Right. So if like what, school gets out and you go to work at 3:30 or 4 o'clock, now just everything gets back. There's only so many hours in a day. You're going to pay the price on the other end, aren't you?
Yeah. So if you, which a lot of teenagers do work, you know, the older ones, and have after-school activities. So if you mix both of those, and then when do you have time for homework? And then you're up all night. So it's not necessarily just kids are going to stay up late. A lot of them have to.
Just seems to me like if we could manage it, it would make sense. Just because you and I suffer doesn't mean the kids have to.
Well, there's already a lot of pressure on kids these days. I think more than even when I was in high school, which was over 10 years ago. But, well, way more than that, actually. My 10-year reunion was last year. But I even notice it. It's intense.
And, you know, I am one of these people, to be honest with you. I am one of these people who, when they talk about how do we make millennials happy in the workplace, I kind of roll my eyes because I'm of a school where you just worked hard for the boss. And if you were lucky, you got a raise someday. And that's the way it is. Now we're like, what kind of food do they like? What can we do? Can they work at home? We won't even have vacation days. When they can't come in, that's okay. It's just so soft, right? And I don't understand that. I guess I just had that myself and I didn't get it. So now I'm resentful, maybe, of this generation that's going to work, and employers are just falling over themselves to make it easy
on them. That's exactly it.
That's me.
Right, because the workers now, like we were always made to feel as if we were lucky to have a job, right?
Well, yeah.
Right.
We were. That's still in my hard drive.
Well, I think everyone in this business feels that
way. Maybe it's this business too more, yeah. But, I mean, you know, that's not neither extreme is the right way to do it.
Okay, but then I need to reconcile that with my attitude about kids going to school after this. Tim, you're on WGN. What's on your mind?
How you doing? I think I had the earliest start time. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning.
For school?
For school. It was middle school. Back in the 70s, we were on a 45-15 plan because we had so many kids. And for our kids in our middle school, there was still so many kids that they split shift. We had another town that was using our school, so oh. I started at 6 o'clock in the morning, got out at noon, and then the next school started at noon and got out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's a lose-lose. That everybody's got a bad deal
there. I'll tell you what, this school had no windows. So when you went in there at dark and you got out and it was sunny out, you couldn't see for a good 3 to 5 minutes.
What town was this?
Romeoville.
Are you sure you weren't in a Guatemalan prison?
Well, actually, the school that I was in, like I said, it had no windows. It had four pods. And all it was like the center was where the cafeteria and the library and all that stuff was in the middle. And then you had four different pods. You walked around a circle. You only went one way. Because if you went the other way, you'd get in trouble because it's the traffic. So if you had, your locker was by pod one,
yeah.
and you had to go to pod two,
yeah.
that was okay. But pod four, you had to walk all the way around just to get to your class.
Romeoville, shame on you. I'm out of time. Tim, thanks for the phone call.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
At 2:07, we are happy to be with you. I'll tell you what, September wasn't too bad. October's been pretty good, wouldn't you say?
Lord have mercy.
I wish it would stay just a little warmer, a little longer, but it's another nice week looking at us. And we're here on this beautiful day until 3. Then Rokan and Anna DeVlantis will say hi. Remember, the Mincing Rascals podcast is yours just by saying to your smart speaker, play the Mincing Rascals podcast. Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn from the Tribune, and friends of ours join a weekly roundtable. It's a podcast that many of you came up to me over the weekend and said, love the Mincing Rascals, John. Maybe that's why the Illinois Broadcasters Association said it's the best podcast in the state.
Did they tell you at all who their favorite person was on the podcast?
Didn't come up, Steve, but I'm sure they would have said Eric.
He's mine.
So this lady, Marilyn Hartman, has done it again. She gets past security and she either gets onto a plane or sometimes onto the destination.
Well, I think in this case, they saw her trying to move TSA barrier lines.
I was wondering what got her arrested.
Yeah. She didn't get close to the plane.
Here's the headline, or the first sentence in a story that was on Fox 32's website. A 67-year-old woman with a history of sneaking onto flights without a ticket will remain jailed after the latest incident in which police say she tried to get past security at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. She's been doing this for over a decade now. Sometimes she does get away with it. I saw her interviewed at one point, and she just kind of looked down and said, boy, I hope this never happens again. Almost as if she's unable to control her own impulse to try and get on an airplane.
Well, don't you think that's probably the case?
Oh, of course I do.
Yeah.
I have compassion for this woman and sympathy for her, and I don't think our concern should be, what are we going to do with Marilyn Hartman? It's, how does Marilyn Hartman get away with it? How does she get as far as she sometimes does? I mean, you've been to TSA, you've been to an airport, and I know they're busy and it's crowded, but I've never thought, oh, I know how I can get through this. I just don't see it. Now, maybe it helps that she's a meek, mild-mannered, unassuming, 67-year-old, white, Swedish-looking woman. I mean, she just looks the very definition of civility and somebody who will behave, somebody who will follow the rules. There she is, sneaking around.
Her probation prohibited her from even going to the airport.
Yeah, right. Her arrest marks the latest in a story that played out for a decade at airports across the country, including last year when she was arrested after sneaking onto a flight from O'Hare to London. See, this is what should concern us. It's not her, it's that. It's not the person, it's the action. Peter Greenberg is a travel expert you may see on the CBS Morning News. He's a guest on this show frequently, and we asked him to comment on it. Hi, Peter. How are you today?
I am great. See, my compulsion is I just try to get off the plane as often as I can.
Yeah. as quickly as possible.
The bottom line here is if you know what you're doing and you don't call attention to yourself and you blend in, you have a possibility of doing this, especially when you consider the fact that, and I'm not saying this happened in her case or in the most recent case, but there are a lot of airports that will give you what's called a gate pass. And a gate pass is if maybe you're taking an unaccompanied minor to their plane or you're going to meet somebody. We even have airports like in Pittsburgh that will give you a gate pass if you just want to go shopping at the airport and even if you have no plane to catch at all. So what the TSA does, and you do this every time you travel, you know this, they ask for a government-issued ID, and they match that ID with the name printed on the boarding pass. They don't often check the flight, and they don't often check the date. So if you were that determined and you made believe like you had someplace to go, it's entirely possible you could get through, but you needed a boarding pass. That you have to have. And so that was, I have no idea, quite frankly, how she's been able to do it without a boarding pass.
But you just make it sound like in Pittsburgh, if you wanted to shop at the duty-free stores in those malls they have in airports now, I could get in without a boarding pass.
Absolutely, they have. It's a new program they've had for a couple of months now. Other airports are trying it because they want their retail to thrive. So what they give you is a gate pass, which will allow you to get through TSA security and basically go shopping. Now remember, when you get to the gate, they still have to take that pass and put it in the reader if they're going to put you on the plane, and it's never going to show up based on that reader if
right.
you just have a gate pass to go shopping.
Well, so
once again. Yeah,
I don't know that we have that. I don't know that we have that set up at O'Hare, but say she did this in Pittsburgh. Unless she's on some blacklist, you know, like don't let Marilyn even shop at the airport, unless they have her pre-screened, you know, and they wouldn't let her in. It sounds like she could have gotten into the terminal that way, right?
Oh, sure, and anybody can because it's open to the public.
Well, what do you think?
Meaning,
of that,
if you
Peter?
Just want to go out, if you have a compulsion to shop. And you're near the airport and you just want to go out and shop, they will give you a gate pass, which will get you through the primary security with TSA. It doesn't get you on the plane because they have to pull your boarding pass, and that won't match up with anything.
Are those stores in the airports really a better deal?
Depends on the country. You know, there are some stores that they have to pay such a rent that, you know, plus you're a captive audience to begin with, but you're not necessarily getting a great deal. There are other stores, for example, the duty-free stores at certain airports are a great deal for people who live in countries where the duty on their alcohol purchases are outrageous, and they take advantage of that. It's an airport-by-airport discussion. I can't give you an across-the-board answer.
And I guess it would depend then on your nationality. If you're going to Saudi Arabia, maybe it's hard to buy liquor there. In the United States, it's not. But I've been, you know, I know what call liquor costs because I'll buy bourbon or gin, and I know what I pay for a bottle of Tanqueray. And then I look at those prices, and, you know, I'm always trying to sort of remember in my mind what those spirits cost. And then am I paying a tax? And is it worth it to lug that thing around? You know, I'm always trying to decide in my mind if it's worth the effort and if I'm really saving that much money.
Well, the biggest oxymoron is a duty-free store in a duty-free country. So, for example, all the stores that say they're duty-free in Hong Kong, I mean, you have to be delusional to be excited by that because all of Hong Kong is duty-free. So you're not getting a benefit. But, for example, in Japan, if somebody wants to buy a bottle of whiskey at the airport, they are definitely getting a deal versus buying one in Tokyo.
What do you make of these stores that are allowing airports that are allowing people to shop there? I thought we were trying to screen people out, have as few people as possible, or make these airports as safe as possible.
Well, I doubt there are people who get up in the morning to want to go to a mall that happens to be at an airport. However, in a situation where you're taking somebody to the airport, you're a meter and a greeter, and you're waiting for a flight to come in, or you're waiting to make sure that somebody gets on their plane, I don't have a problem with that. Otherwise, you're just loitering anyway, and you're there to begin with. So I'm not worried about that.
You know, in Chicago, people, instead of loitering in the mall at the airport, are idling in their cars on the expressway on the shoulder just before the airport. Now, we have parking lots where they're supposed to go, but in a lot of cities, they still just pull off on the median on the side of the highway outside the airport. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I do. At many, many airports, I'm talking to you now from New York today, you go out to Kennedy today, you'll see on the shoulders, on the off-ramps, people just waiting because they're waiting to get the text message from their significant other or loved one or business partner that they're now waiting at baggage, and then they're going to go pick them up. The real problem is what's happening now at airports like Los Angeles, where the growth in Uber and Lyft has made such congestion happen at arrivals that they're now banning them all in Los Angeles. By the end of this month, a new rule. You cannot come out of the airport from arrivals with your bags and get a taxi. You can't get a Lyft. You can't get an Uber. You have to board a shuttle bus that will then take you to a remote parking lot where you can get those rides. It's going to maximize the schlep factor exponentially, and no one likes that.
All of that because of ride-sharing programs now?
Yeah, because of basic congestion at the airport, yeah.
Yeah. What do you make of, just while I got you on the phone here, just two other questions then. Back to this Marilyn Hartman lady, the meek, mild-mannered 67-year-old lady who got herself arrested trying to get on a flight in Chicago. She didn't, but that's what she's been able to do before. She was supposed to stay out of airports completely. She's still being held. Here's the sentence that I don't exactly understand. Friday night and later charged with felony criminal trespass. Judge on Sunday granted her bail but ordered that she stay in custody until a related probation hearing for something else, I guess. I'm not exactly sure when that's going to take place. But are you satisfied with the level of security at airports these days, Peter, or are we too lax? What do you think about that? Because she oftentimes is getting through.
Well, you know, given the number of incidents that we've seen, and I'm talking about the few number of incidents, I'd have to say in terms of maintaining a perimeter of security at the airport, I think given the number of people traveling, they're doing a relatively good job. Mm-hmm. I have to give them credit for that. The issue that I have is not the security itself. It's how the TSA is manning the security areas properly so that the flow of people is not getting crazy. I mean, the TSA is not acting in an entrepreneurial spirit at all.
Yeah.
You know, they close off TSA checkpoints at the height of some push times at airports. It makes absolutely no sense. The pre-check lines are closed off. I mean, what I want to say, for those people who listen to the show who may be a member of pre-check, I'm sure you're going to share the same story that I have, is that if I'm spending $100 a year, or maybe $85 a year, to be a member of that program, then that means that every time I go to the airport, I should be able to use that program. And I think the only way to get the TSA back on track here is that every time I or anybody else goes to the airport and those pre-check lines are closed, I should get an immediate $10 rebate check. and that's how fast TSA is going to turn things around. Because if they don't have any financial consequence to closing the gates or closing those lines, they're just going to continue to do it.
Here's my global entry story, Peter Greenberg, travel expert. You see him on the CBS Morning News. So Brenda and I travel internationally about once a year, and we both, within about 48 hours of each other, applied for global entry. Mine went through in about 3 weeks. Several months later, Brenda's still hasn't been approved for an interview, you know, for the final step. It's amazing. And so there's no purpose in my getting through lines quicker, global entry, because Brenda's got to wait, so we stand there together.
Exactly.
And I paid good money for the global entry thing. What can you say about all that?
Well, to be fair, I have my issues with pre-check and with security in general, but I have to say that global entry in concept and most of the time in execution is an exceptionally good program because it really works. And the problem is getting that interview. I just posted something on my website showing that the interview hours at certain TSA checkpoints to get the interview for global entry are ridiculous. They're closed on Saturdays and Sundays. They're only open for a few hours every day. So if you're not planning your trip to the airport to get the interview to coincide with an actual flight you're on that actually coincides with their opening hours, it's a joke. Again, they're not operating in an entrepreneurial spirit. to be able to make it easy. But if you do get it, and I tell you, John, when she does get it, you're going to thank everybody for this program. It really does work.
What is the point of the interview? My wife and I just went through it within the past few months, and there were very few relevant questions when it comes to travel. Or I don't really know what they were asking me or what they were looking for.
Well, you remember filling out the application.
Sure.
And when you filled out the application, in my case, it took me 2 hours to fill it out because they ask you to list every country you've ever been in
yeah.
your entire life.
Yep. And when you were there.
You can imagine how long that took me.
Yeah.
But then they then match that against any problems you may have had coming back in the country. Maybe you didn't declare something at customs, or you tried to bring something in that was dutiable but you didn't pay it. And that interview is supposed to make sure that you are the person you say you are. They have a visual inspection with you. Obviously, they're looking at you face to face, and then they sign off. I know very few people who had the interview who were turned down, but the point is you got to first get the interview, and that's where they're falling down on the job because they're not keeping the hours open to schedule the number of applicants properly.
I never sounded stupider than when I was sitting there across from the guy. He's just making small talk, and I'm giving complicated, awkward answers. I'm starting to perspire. I'm thinking, you know, it's like when a cop pulls you over, when you see a cop and all of a sudden you get real nervous, you're going to do something wrong. That was me. Last thing, though, Peter, I got to go. But what's the great benefit of Global Entry? What do you get when you get that?
The great benefit of Global Entry is who wants to fly on an 11-hour flight and then stand in line for 2 hours to clear customs once you land? Here's the situation. You have your Global Entry. They basically have your information at the point of departure when they swipe your passport. They know what flight you're on. They've already cleared you through the crime index so that when you land at a U.S. gateway airport, you take your passport, you put it into a kiosk. The photograph of your passport matches. It takes a photograph of you. It asks you to put your four fingers of your right hand, and it reads those fingerprints. And it asks you a series of about seven questions that are, by the way, the answer to each question is no. And then that takes all of 30 seconds. You get a receipt, and you even beat your bags out. I mean, it's great.
Peter Greenberg's the travel expert. Nice to talk to you, Peter. Thanks for your time today.
Anytime, John.
I always appreciate it. He visited with producer Elif off the air for a little while, and he said, you know, if there is a way for that Marilyn Hartman to get through, and it sounded like he knew more than he tipped his hand here, he said, I'm not sure it's going to be in the best interest of public safety if I told you how to get through TSA to get past that line and into the terminal. I don't know that that does anybody any favors. But on the air, it wasn't clear to him. It sure sounded like exactly what she was doing. How she does it, I do not know. A friend of mine just walked into the studio and said that Global Entry is the bomb. It's really awesome. But we can't get it. We can't get it. So, and he had trouble getting his as well, his interview for Global Entry. I mean, it's a government program. You pay money for it. What's the point if you can't use it?
Sharon applied months before I did, and I got mine. And then I got my interview within weeks, and it took her probably 3 or 4 months.
Brenda's been waiting for half a year, I'd say. When I got in for my interview, we virtually signed up at the same time. I said, what's up with that? And he goes, oh, yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to it. The people that do the interview that you got to get this thing with here to get your thing done have nothing to do with the scheduling. Somebody else does that. And on the website, it says, due to the government shutdown, it may be a long time before you get your interview. What government shutdown? The last government shutdown was a long time ago. Is that what we're talking about? Very strange. So our colleague here, Steve, he drove to Detroit. He couldn't get his interview in Chicago. He got in his car, drove to Detroit. And at least he was able to get his interview there. This is your tax dollars, not hard at work. What do we got here? 228. There was a special pullout section in the New York Times over the weekend. They gathered people from every congressional district in the United States. And they staggered it so that the assembled people, 426 people, would sort of represent the age, race, and gender of America. So what if you got a representative sample of everybody in the United States that votes in an election, every congressional district, and you put them in a conference center for a weekend and had them talk, what would happen? So they did. And a lot of them were from Chicago. This thing was sort of organized by some people at the University of Chicago. You should hear what they found out.
So cute, we talk a little on my. Can she still
7:36, this is WGN. Thank you, Steve. Producer Elif, after the 2:30 news, always plays a song for a reason. What are we listening to, Elif?
This is Sulley. She's a K-pop singer from the band FX, and she died at the age of 25 today. Police speculate suicide as the cause of her death. And Sulley has suffered with anxiety and even took a hiatus in 2015 from music before releasing this solo song, Goblin.
I saw the picture of her. I don't follow the K-pop scene. I understand it's a big deal. The music sounds pretty good usually to me. She's a lovely young lady. 25, huh? What a sad story.
Yeah.
2:37. There was in the New York Times over the weekend, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a special pullout section. And the front page of the section has nothing but the pictures of people from all around the country in various states from all of the congressional districts. And it said, these voters represent all of America. When you open it up, you see more pictures and pages of pictures of people. There's not a lot of writing. It's more visual. I suppose there's writing somewhere, but I don't see it in my section. Maybe I got to go online to find out more about it. But it was just interesting to say, okay, every congressional district across the country, right? What do Americans look like? And then what they did was they put them all in the same place for a weekend, as I understand it, and sort of had a conference with them about how they're feeling about certain issues. And the way the article reads, what writing there is with it, it sounds like it was coordinated by some folks at the University of Chicago. They have this National Opinion Research Center there. And Mike Dennis is one of the people there. He's a senior vice president of something called the Amerispeak panel. We found him over, I guess, at the U of C this afternoon to talk to us a little bit. Mike, it's John. How are you today?
Very good. Nice to meet you, John.
That's at least my read on this. Tell me what else I should know about what was in my Sunday paper.
Well, you have a good synopsis there. We're very proud to have been part of this study at the NORC at the University of Chicago. And our role is to bring a representative sample of registered voters to the Gaylord Resort for 4 days of deliberations. And the leadership for this project have been doing this kind of work, John, for over three decades. And that's Professor James Fishkin at Stanford and Larry Diamond, also at Stanford University. And essentially what happened is that we had a diverse representative group of Americans, complete strangers to each other, come to the Dallas, Texas area and for 4 days talk about issues that a lot of people think are dividing our society. But in point of fact, when you get these people together in small groups and they get a chance to get to know each other and talk about the issues in detail, they end up finding out that they have a lot in common. And I think that's what the final report said. And you mentioned the New York Times being short on words. I can tell you that Professor Fishkin and Diamond, at their website, they have a complete analysis that you can download to learn all the details.
What were some of the conclusions they came to based on this four-day sort of conference with all of these people?
Well, for me, one of the most remarkable findings is the extent to which people that came to that meeting with extreme political views, whether on the left or the right, they ended up softening their positions. So those who take a strong anti-immigrant or immigration stance, Professor Fishkin and Diamond are able to demonstrate a softening of those attitudes as a result of this experience of being able to talk about the issues and meet with experts. And the same thing on the left, too. Professor Fishkin also notes those with more left-leaning or progressive methodologies also tended to gravitate toward more centrist positions. Now, did this happen for all the delegates that were there? Clearly not. But there were some statistical patterns there that were clearly in evidence and could be described.
You know, it sort of makes you think about the soundbite mentality that the media and politicians who use the media, are subjected to, right? I mean, we hear extreme sound bites on CNN from the president at a rally, and then we'll see Joe Biden or somebody like that say something very strident about the president, and it's just driving everybody in opposite directions, isn't it?
Well, this is clearly a major theme right now is the extent to which our media are actually exacerbating political tensions in our society. And an event like this, I think, is a useful reminder that most of the country is relatively centrist. I mean, if you look at the information that we collected from these delegates before they got to Dallas, 4 out of 10 you would describe as political moderates based on the information that they gave us. Most were independents, or they're just left of center politically, or just right of center politically in terms of ideology. So I think you're right. I think, you know, there is a, in some sense, a pattern where controversy in terms of public opinion is better for ratings. And having people agree with each other just isn't that exciting in terms of getting eyeballs on screens. But I think that is an interesting story. And I think that by bringing these 526 people together, there was a useful reminder here for all of us that it's possible if we get off social media and we actually talk to each other, some good things can happen.
Well, did they talk about things like, say, gun legislation? That's certainly something important to America that we seem to be unable to do anything about.
Well, I'm not so sure about the gun issue, John, but I can tell you health care, immigration, foreign policy issues, taxation. These were major issues that were discussed. And one thing I'll mention to you is that before the delegates actually got to Dallas, there was a 56-page briefing document. That's right, 56 pages that they were expected to read. And these 56 pages went through the 5 issue areas that were identified beforehand. So there was a tremendous amount of education that occurred for these delegates before they came. And they took it seriously. We were really impressed by the delegates' attention and investment in time that they made so they could be informed when they came to the actual meeting.
And they've been doing this for a few decades? This conference has been going
on
for a long time, huh? And do they just randomly call people and say, hey, you've been selected and we're going to fly you out? Who pays for all of this?
Yeah, I'll mention a few things in that connection. One of the very first ones was in 1996, and it was hosted in person in Austin, Texas. And my organization, NORC, at the University of Chicago, was responsible for that. In fact, one of our directors, Norman Bradburn, led that operation for NORC back in 1996. In terms of who's funding this, there's a wonderful foundation called Helena Group. And they're a nonpartisan organization trying to make a dent in our society for good, in my view. And they're the ones that put up the funding for this very elaborate operation, which, as you pointed out, involves flying out all 526 delegates. Some of them were obviously in Dallas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, so they could drive, but about 90% needed some help with air travel. In terms of how the selections were made, we at NORC, we already have a representative sample of 35,000 households designed to represent the entire country. And what we did there was a very scientific process to identify a group within our panel of households, these 35,000 households, to make sure that they would represent the whole country in terms of party identification, political ideology, right, race, ethnicity. We're really proud of the young. If you look at those pictures there in the New York Times that you started the segment with, you'll see how many young adults we actually had there. We were really proud that, you know, young adult America turned up for America in One Room.
Yeah, I have some things to say about it. I mean, there's a couple of things that I think are pretty striking when you look at a sampling of 526 faces that represent the United States of America. But before I get to that, except that we're more centrist than maybe the politicians who are trying to win our favor are, what are some conclusions that you come to, or what do you do with this? Okay, so maybe we're all actually more moderate than you'd think, but then what about that, right?
Well, I think one thing that's possible here is how do we create America in One Room type events on a much larger scale in the future? Professor Fishkin, he has a remarkable phrase where he talks about how social media has been used to divide us in the past as a country. Well, how about using social media as a force for good, where we can do basically web-based Americas in One Room, where we can bring together tens of thousands of people in productive and civil conversations about the issues that supposedly divide this country. So I think this is actually a microcosm of what could be possible on a much larger scale. by using technology to our advantage. And we're aware that Professor Fishkin and his colleagues are working on a technology that would enable this kind of scaling up of American One Room.
Yeah. You'd have to have somebody moderate the chats on that, right? I mean, isn't it a shame that when on social media you get a bunch of people together, the comments page just pollute the commentary?
Well, isn't it? I mean, perhaps it's possible to have civil but still automated moderators. I think that it's not out of the question that the moderators themselves could represent or be use some form of artificial intelligence, for instance, to give us the ability to do this at very large scale. And so it's a little bit of a dream, I'll admit that, John, but it's something that we're working on.
Okay, but then say we do that, then at least the University of Chicago or anybody would be able to point to this massive democratic, you know, with a small D group of people who represent all the districts in the United States, and by golly, they say this about gun control or healthcare or immigration or Syria. I mean, there would be a clear voice instead of the two sides sniping at each other and never knowing who to believe.
That's right. And it may not surprise you to know that you're not the first person to come up with this idea. The idea is to have an informed citizenry, maybe a cabinet of sorts, a citizen's cabinet, that could advise us on what informed voters think about the issues. Now, is that a representative sample of voters? Of course not. You know, these delegates are changed by the experience of reading these briefing books, meeting their fellow Americans, having the conversations. They are changed in some ways. That's both the blessing and the curse of this kind of methodology. It's a blessing because we get to know what Americans think after they have a chance to think about the issues and talk with their fellow Americans about it. But it can also obviously be criticized as not representing America as we know it, because we obviously had a big intervention in the lives of these delegates by bringing them to Dallas.
You mean that what? That, in fact, all of America isn't going to go through what these people went through, so this is kind of an artificial panel just because they all got in the same room together.
That's right. I mean, it's artificial, but is that necessarily a bad thing?
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
What we did was, I think one thing I'll mention here, John, is that the whole project has a level of idealism around it that I find inspiring and, frankly, heartwarming. You know, this idea that if you do bring people together, you inform them. We spend all this money to create this laboratory of registered voters. There's an idealism about that. And it does go back, I think, to the town halls that we like to talk about and learn when we're in high school or even younger, and we're learning about what our early democracy was like in this country. It was largely about villages and small towns and neighbors getting together and deciding things. And I think this American One Room comes back to that time.
Mike Dennis is on a phone line from the University of Chicago, the National Opinion Research Center, and they coordinated with others to put this event together where, well, the way the New York Times writes about it in this special pullout section with the pictures of the 526 people, it simply says, these voters represent all of America, and then at the bottom of the page it says, and they spent a weekend together. And you think, wow, how interesting. You know, it's funny because when I think about a sort of sampling of Americana these days, what happens often is Donald Trump will have a rally in Minneapolis, or he's going to have a rally, he's going to be here in Chicago, say, and all of the people will line up. And what will they be? They'll look like middle-aged to older white Americans, and then the camera will go by, and it's the exact opposite of what this page of pictures looks like. And then the commentary from anybody will be very snarky. They'll try and ridicule those people or paint them in a negative light, or they'll say negative things. But it's the very, very opposite of what I'm looking at right now. And I have to say this, if you do then look at 526 people in this country from all of the congressional, what is it, one person from each congressional district, is that what you did?
No. But we end up having, John, people from 47 states there in the Washington, D.C. area. And so we did not do it by congressional districts. Our goal was to have a representative sample of all of America, as opposed to just going to congressional districts specifically.
I see.
So we did have Hawaii there. We had at least two people from Vermont. I met the nice lady from Maine who came over. There's, I got to tell you, John, there's just so many remarkable stories on an individual level of people who've never been on airplanes before who came to this event. You know, I know of at least one young lady who did not tell her family that she was coming.
Yeah, I read that.
Because, you know, you read about that too. So there are a lot of precious stories like that. I met a young lady actually who attended, and she was in between dialysis sessions. She has renal disease, and she thought it was important enough to come to this event, even in those circumstances, leaving her teenage kids at home.
Wow.
But I can tell you, FaceTiming with them a lot based on what I saw.
Well, but you have a map here then, and it shows where they're from. And it looks like an electoral college map, right? Los Angeles, Chicago, the Northeast, Houston, Miami,
right.
Those areas are heavily represented because that's where the people are. And when you then look at the pictures of these people, a couple of things jump out at you. And one is that it's not all white folks living in America, is it?
That's right.
It's very ethnically diverse. And it's not just black and white, obviously, but when you just see it page by page, picture by picture, you get a sense of the hue of America, don't you?
That's right. Yeah, and I think that was one of the motivations that the New York Times had for doing this. And operationally, John, I'll just mention it was challenging to assemble everybody for headshots for this. But the end product, I think, is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And I have to mention to you, you know, it is a representative sample of registered voters in the country. But we at NORC, we made sure that we had a representative sample on race and ethnicity and also young adults. We did not want to get things right, so to speak, just on political party identification.
Right.
We really curated this sample, if you will, to make sure that it would look like America at the end of the day. We knew that there were going to be television cameras. There was a film documentary crew there the whole time, John, interviewing the researchers such as myself and the delegates there. There were a lot of eyeballs on this event. And we wanted to make sure that, you know, it would actually be a representative look at who we are right now as a country.
Well, if you want to see what that looks like, what Mike Dennis is talking about from the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago, where can we go? It was in Sunday's New York Times, but where can I read more about the findings and see some of this stuff, Mike?
Sure. I refer you to a website at Stanford University. It's called the Center for Deliberative Democracy, CDD, Center for Deliberative Democracy. You can find the full report there, all the statistical tables. Just a reminder, John, we did the survey of these delegates several months ago, and then we surveyed them again on the exact same issues as they were leaving this four-day meeting. So that's how we're able to measure the extent to which people's ideas and beliefs and political ideas were changing as a result of this.
By the way, are you on a farm right now?
It's an unusual situation. I have neighbors with roosters, John. That's all I can tell you.
Because when I think of the University of Chicago, I don't think of roosters going in the background, but there they are.
Yeah, there they are. My apologies to that, but this is my home office situation today.
I think it's utterly charming. And did you say you do or don't mind having roosters living next door?
My wife has a different opinion on all this. I actually have grown to like them over time. So it works out well for us, and it keeps my dogs entertained as well. So there's that plus.
Yeah, you've kept us entertained. Nice work on that. So CDD, the Center for Deliberative, what's that again?
Center for Deliberative Democracy. At Stanford University.
All right.
And I wanted to simply, if I could, John, acknowledge our NORC team. We had a couple dozen people work really hard to get this representative sample there and get the surveys done. And they're all based there in the Chicago area, with a couple of exceptions. So Chicago definitely put its imprint on this study.
Yeah, so I can tell in the Sunday's New York Times if you just pick up a copy of it, too. Well done. Nice to talk to you. We should meet again, Mike. My best to you and all of the farm animals where you are today.
Very good. Thanks for the time today, John.
Yeah, have a good day. That's Mike Dennis at the University of Chicago National Opinion Research Center.